Welcome back to the Out of the Woods, your go-to podcast for threat hunting insights. I'm your host, Scott Poley.
And I am Tom Kastur.
In this weekly segment, we break down the stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. So let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for August 11th, 2025. Tom, what do you got for us today?
All right, kicking it off. I got a blog from Silent Push. It's titled Unmasking SOC Ghoulish. Silent Push untangles the malware web behind the pioneer of fake updates. And its operator, TA-569. So, threat actor TA-569, the group behind SOC Ghoulish, is an initial access broker that specializes in selling compromised system access to other criminal groups, including ransomware operators and state-sponsored actors. So, TA-569, they compromise legitimate high-traffic websites and typically inject malicious JavaScript that serves like fake browser update prompts. It's kind of one of their MOs to unsuspecting visitors. They leverage traffic distribution systems. So I'm going to kind of refer to this as TDS. So their campaigns are routed through systems like Parrot TDS and Kataro TDS. You can kind of think of these systems in a similar way as advertisement tracking and delivery. So like, for instance, you carry a marker to a given site and you're served up with those kind of pesky little ads of things that you were like just talking about to someone or were looking at or browsing, previously in another day. But from there, the TDS filters victims by things like geography, the OS they're using, the browser type, even screen size, kind of targeted for that mobile delivery as an example, and more to deliver tailored payloads or redirect to tailored destinations for either payloads or to obfuscate activity and kind of hide the intent from, say, like a researcher trying to unmask them. So some of the additional filtering that occurs by SOC Ghoulish, so WordPress admins, users don't get a payload per Silent Push's research. Users who have already executed a payload won't get served a payload again. Users who use an automated web browser, like a web driver, get redirected to the first type of payload. Users who have unusually small screen size, so we're talking like mobile phones or even some sandbox, some sandbox solutions, they'll get redirected to another payload. Users who have that ad view enabled key set to true, they don't get a payload because the script uses this variable to ensure the inject is only executed once. And then users who've passed all these checks will then get served the main payload. So a couple interesting things here that I found interesting in this read-up. And it's a pretty in-depth write-up as well. There's a lot of meat here. It was a fun read for me. But the user interaction that's kind of required. So the victims must click on the fake update to trigger that drive-by download, kind of dropping that SOC Ghoulish payload. But some of the interesting notes here discovered by Silent Push's research, there appear to be three stages that are both tracked and logged back to SOC Ghoulish operators, as well as key functions to a decision point of whether or not to execute the next steps in the chain. So first, they track if the user's mouse is moved. So that's the first checkbox. Then if it hovers over the link, that's number two. And then if it was clicked. So Silent Push theorizes that this mechanism is in place to kind of filter out real users from fake ones or people that are trying to just do research over the malicious landing spot. Also some evasion tactics, heavy reliance on domain shadowing, hijacking subdomains from legitimate domains and kind of a real rapid domain rotation. So as they discussed and pointed out, they're, full domain rotation in their campaigns within 2 or 3 days, really to evade that detection and those takedown methods. There is a lot of infrastructure overlap. So that Kataro TDS that I had mentioned before, that's also been tied to Russian disinformation operations. So it's really suggesting that there's this potential shared operators or infrastructure between both cybercrime and influence campaigns. Also, there's collaboration points that are pointed out here. So those infections from SOC Ghoulish often lead to secondary malware. So they specifically call out things like Raspberry Robin ties with ransomware delivery from groups like Evil Core or Lockbit, really just kind of indicating this kind of like it's not one group, it's a multitude of groups. And, there is quite a bit in this blog post, Scott. I kind of ran through it a little bit quick, but I thought it was a good read. And I thought the breakdown of how this how they're kind of tying all these aspects together was really well read. It made me want to kind of take aim at that sort of lore that occurs on the defender side, you know, of that, that, you know, focusing a lot on attribution. Cause I know we have run into this in the past, right? Where the first thing we do when we have to report upwards is attribute it to X, Y, or Z to kind of put that kind of category around what's happening. But I think this kind of gives a bit more of that press to say, there's a lot of people on the threat actor side collaborating. We're seeing it more and more. So, you know, really, I'll take a breath. I'll pause and see what you thought of this. It was a media article, so I'm curious what you came out
of. Oh, yeah. So, you know, the one thing that I liked was the depth of coverage to kind of explain, like, the whole, I want to use the term attack surface, but, like, the surface of this type of attack in general, being able to just navigate and use, like, modern technology that we use now with the internet and things, to make it easier to direct attacks at people and make it dynamic, make them agile. It's just kind of cool how it lays out all the different pieces. And I mean, and we know, like, you know, when web developers develop certain sites, we know that they, based on user agents, try to target, you know, for mobile versus this versus that, so that you have a good user experience. It's almost like they've used the user experience, capabilities to really make their campaigns really strong. But the good news is even though, like, this might be really hard to, you know, discover or analyze, based on how they're kind of have some dodgy methods to avoid that, they're usually delivering things that are well researched and have good fingerprints. So, like, you know, they mentioned, like, a typical delivery for a Windows system was like the Dolly Loader or Luma Stealer, versus macOS. If it's a macOS driven thing, then they have a different type of stealer malware. And those have, you know, hooks and things that you can look for when it comes to, like, a lot of the stealers even use the current version run stuff, the register keys that we always talk about. So that's kind of how I feel like you'd have to go after what the drops are. But the one thing I thought was really interesting was I've never heard of domain shadowing before. So they brought that up, and I thought that was interesting because, you know, that concept is one of the best ways to block malicious sites is if it has a poor reputation or no reputation at all, that a lot of proxies or web proxies that are deployed or managed can leverage. But the whole idea they had there was they would compromise a known site and then create a subdomain of that site. So they're almost, you know, building infrastructure off of something to then leverage their reputation to make it, you know, so things won't get blocked. I thought that was interesting. I also liked how if someone went to a site and it was something to do with, like, they're already the admin or they're, you know, going into something via as the admin, then they won't get loaded or hit with the malware. And I think it was more like a anti analysis so that it wouldn't look fishy. So the admins will be able to determine if their site was compromised in order to then fix all that. So I thought that was kind of an interesting approach as well. But overall, it's just really interesting to see how they're using the TDS and the different forks. They have a good graphic in the actual article that, you know, shows how, like, what decision and branches things take depending on how you interact with a site and how or what they want to deliver, which is really cool and informative. So, yeah, it's something that I think people just have to kind of take a minute to actually check out this whole article and some of the things I mentioned. But like I said, it's probably one of the blogs that have covered this topic to this depth that I've seen so far really well. So, yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, and expected to only kind of evolve from there, right? Because the more data points that we put out there, the more they're going to leverage them. And the TDS thing was just really creative to me. Like, I just thought it was, like, it made sense, right? But it's not something you necessarily thought of before. Like, okay, leveraging this kind of mechanism to drive people where they want. Also to leverage it in those kind of creative ways to obfuscate themselves, to kind of hide what they're doing so they can't easily be attributed.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool.
All right, Scott, what you got next?
I'm going to jump to, it's a Talos, intelligence blog, and it's called Mavertising Campaign Leads to PS1 Bot and Multi-Stage Malware Framework. This one is, kind of media as well as far as what they are talking about. But basically, there's a malware campaign going that leads to dropping PS1 bot, which is kind of a modular PowerShell-ish malware. One of the cool things it also does is it tries not to leave too many things on the system. So even some of the C-sharp code that is run from this malware is kind of compiled on the fly as part of how it builds. So it's interesting, you know, but the big thing I think is the big takeaway here is most of the time this is kind of delivered via an archive, a zip file, right? And what's inside the archive is just, they say it's called full document.js. So you're running a JS file basically, and that's just the initial downloader that's going to pull things in. So yeah, already that's kind of suspicious in itself, but that means that if it does that, and then there's PowerShell involved as well, we've talked about it before, right? This script interpreter chaining effect that leads to a lot of how malware gets moved in and executed. So in this case, you're looking for something like, you know, WScript, CScript type things executing PowerShell, which isn't that terribly common. But that's probably the most obvious thing that you can use to try to identify some of the other things. There's a lot of stuff that PowerShell does, and whether or not it will show up in like the PowerShell logging that we always talk about. I don't know if it will, because it looks like since it's kind of creating loading modules, it's just has functions defined that do a lot of the behaviors that a lot of people use when they use PowerShell maliciously. So like how they download objects or create an object in PowerShell to download, that behavior we've seen before, some of the other things it does to like monitor and grab things we've seen as well being done in PowerShell. But since it's modules, I think it's not going to be as apparent in the logging itself. One of the interesting things though is it does have like a C2 element, and it sets up a sleep timer and just uses basic sleep. So it's kind of on like a pretty fixed clock from an interval perspective in some of the examples they were showing. So that was interesting. They did show, like for instance, they do a lot of capturing of anything you do via the keyboard, and they throw, and that's being sent in those web requests, and you can kind of even see the pattern of this, you know, it's tracking when you open certain things, what was typed, and everything, all within just this concatenated chain, which is kind of cool to see from the web traffic perspective. They also are targeting multiple browsers, because obviously they're trying to steal things with a lot of this stuff. And so I'm always interested when attackers do like have those lists built, because they're doing all the research on who their target audience is. And I always learn like about new things that I didn't know people were even using or they existed. So there's a ton of browsers I've never seen before. But you know, they basically target those. They even target multi-factor authentication and cryptocurrency wallet extensions that, you know, Chromium can have as another way to get at other things they could steal potentially. So there's just some really good lists from just that perspective that I think is really cool too. This provided just for, you know, extra research as far as, you know, how would people go about attacking these things? Because if they're targeting them and they're having success, so there's reasons, and down the road, you're probably going to see the similar target sets as far as like other browsers and other things being hit too. If motives line up similarly from different groups to groups. So that part was kind of cool. But yeah, like I said, it's just interesting to see how much is being done via PowerShell, and probably not much is being detectable via the whole PowerShell approach, except for that initial execution. And that's why I've always, I think, favored execution and persistence for the most part, because there's always something that's going to usually lead to some sort of identification of at least weird stuff, right? So those, that's where I'd kind of focus my efforts when looking for something like this or concerned about something like this. But yeah, what was your kind of takeaway? I know this kind of had a bunch of different like sections that kind of talked about some capabilities. But as far as like when you look at the actual data or technical things, anything stand out to you other than the stuff I was kind of calling out to try to find and detect certain things?
Yeah, kind of around a little bit. One, I guess I'm not 100% certain because of something, a couple things you had stated relative to kind of how it's like modularized. But some of the stuff I'm thinking, like from a perspective of like if you are, you know, in an environment that has that kind of PowerShell script block logging in place, some of the things that I don't know that we necessarily talk about a lot because we usually kind of look farther down on the meat of the chain, but some of the discovery stuff. So, you know, in this article, talk a bunch about some of the WMI querying that's done, right? Like to kind of check for antiviruses, like, you know, your get WMI object kind of call. I think that should appear in the login because it would produce a find or a result, right? Unless I'm mistaken, but things like that are something we don't necessarily talk about. So some of those discovery queries, it can kind of give you kind of a heads up of, hey, something's going down or something is or has detonated inside of your environment, right?
Right. Yeah. So I think you might even, so WMI is always interesting to me because sometimes you can have instances where WMI is being run. And then sometimes there's just like a WMI process that exists that can be basically queried, and it doesn't create new processes when it does things. But if you do have like a chain where you have PowerShell leading to WMI execution, that's something that also can kind of stand out. And, you know, then hopefully if something is executing something, you can also see some of the arguments being passed via the command line.
Right.
But yeah. So yeah, just kind of a cool modular thing, but something where it's like, you know, even things that are savvy, there's still those simple things. It's kind of why this one always, like articles like this stand out to me, is like, it's pretty cool and savvy how they, you know, compile things on the fly and stay under the radar, but their execution of, you know, WScript launching PowerShell to even kick this whole thing off. Those are the activities that you should just commonly be paying attention to anyway. So yeah.
Yep. The behaviors tend to stay the same.
Yeah. So what do you got next?
All right, moving along. So I have an article from ReliaQuest. It's titled A Threat Spotlight, Shiny Hunters Target Salesforce Amid Clues of Scattered Spider Collaboration. So, you know, a couple of reasons talking about this. It's a little bit of an echo past what I had already talked about the collaboration piece, but this has been kind of loud and proud over the last couple of weeks, really. But the Shiny Hunters threat group is reportedly launched a new wave of attacks targeting Salesforce, hitting major organizations like Google, for instance. What's particularly intriguing about this campaign is not only its scale and impact, but its resemblance to previous operations attributed to that scattered spider hacking group. So I'll bucket that in quotes because that's specifically pulled from the article. So, you know, we're kind of talking about the path and the processes here. It's really hard focused on a phishing infrastructure, you know, kind of using, in this case, and what's talked about in this article is use of ticket-themed phishing domains. So you're like ticket-x, y, or z, whatever they're looking to mimic, to kind of mimic a bit of a support workflow. Salesforce-specific spoof domains are also leveraged. So like a company name, -my-salesforce.com and things like that. They've been recently stood up. And you see a lot of that and are being used for credential harvesting pretty heavily. So you see when you look at the crossover piece from Shiny Hunters to Scattered Spiders, so there's a lot of shared tradecraft indicators. So the domain registration patterns that overlap in an evolution, and I'm going to pull this from a couple bullets from the article here, but an evolution from previously attributed 2024 activity. Shiny Hunter has included many of the standard scattered spider identify techniques. So we're talking about highly targeted vishing with the campaigns, impersonating IT support staff to kind of trick employees into authorizing access to malicious connected apps, apps that often masquerade as legitimate tools. So in this case, we're looking at Salesforce, allowing attackers to kind of steal sensitive business data. Okta-themed phishing pages to trick victims into entering credentials during those phishing calls. And then they also point out a VPN obfuscation using Mulvad VPN to perform data exfiltration. And, excuse me. So the evidence includes aliases also like Spider Hunters. So it's SP1D3R Hunters, you know, aliases that are found on breach forms and matching domain structures since back in mid-2024. Direct underground forum discussions with likely participants claiming Shiny Hunters and Scattered Spiders are, quote, one of the same and always have been, unquote. Additional overlap is seen where attributed targets to both Scattered Spider and Shiny Hunters aligned throughout portions of this year. So between April and May, you had both focusing targets on retail trade. Between June and July, insurance. Between June and August, aviation. So you see a lot of different overlap pieces that are occurring here that can kind of tie these two together, or at least collaborating. So the primary strategy from what we see here is really kind of a domain setup and campaign organizations aim to breach Salesforce accounts so they can leverage that for data theft, and follow-on extortion. So victims usually, once they're hit, they're publicly named in data leak forums. So, you know, as an example, one that is probably in most people that's listening ears, but the, you know, Google confirmed its corporate Salesforce instance was breached in June of this year. I believe it was like 2.5 million records or something along those lines of business contact data that was stolen. And the attack was attributed to Shiny Hunters directly. So, you know, while not our typical kind of technical in the weeds article, I am following on that same theme, Scott, you know, kind of talking about seeing clear and heavy evidence of the overlap in attribution. And it's becoming clearer and clearer every day that threat actors are collaborating. It's not something that's guesswork anymore. I think it's very much, the evidence is pretty sound. And they're intertwined in different efforts, and they're leveraging, you know, their specialized tool sets with each other to accomplish, you know, their individual goals. You know, kind of stepping off that soapbox, I guess, you know. I don't know, the collaboration I think we're seeing, I think it's worth mentioning. So, you know, from, especially when we're pointing at our, like our hunters, our analysts, detection engineers, so on, you know, really focusing on those behaviors over the desire to attribute first when kind of digging through your environment, trying to identify, report upwards, understand what's happening and the impact of it. For me, it feels strong to say that out loud, that we need to consider that. I know in times of my past that there has been, you know, you create a tunnel vision almost when you really talk about going after a specific actor, especially if you have, you know, if your environment's lucky enough to have an intel group or a tip that you can leverage or something like that, where you might get hit by this behavior, you do a quick search in your tip and it points you at this one group, but that might get you tunnel visioned on only looking at things that are happening there, and you're missing some of the behaviors that are going on in your environment because you're paying too much attention to that attribution. So yeah. It's something that I know has caused a lot of lull in getting to a resolve before in my past. I'm sure you experienced some of that too, but I just think these are good articles to really point at that topic and to talk about why that, you know, keeping that in your mindset when you are hunting, when you are analyzing, when you are trying to detect these things. But yeah, I'll take a breath, Scott, see what you thought.
Yeah, I mean, I always like the ties when they say that there's a group that could be the same group or, you know, using the same techniques from another group or whatever. Because, you know, especially when you talk about the criminal on the ground, there's definitely some communication that goes on in general. So people are going to learn new things or mimic new things that work. So that's, you know, that to me is interesting. And I've never really cared too much about attribution from the perspective of like, I need to go find X because I'm worried about X. I'm more interested in, hey, when we talk about behaviors, like, well, how many groups do we know actually utilize this? And the attribution piece just helps me understand the validity of like trying to defend against certain things versus, you know, one-offs. Like there's nothing worse than when you're trying to solve a problem and it's such a unique thing that only like one group used at one point in time. And you're like, if I even solve this, do I get much value? So that's my take on some of the attribution workflows and how I think about it or try to utilize it. But in this, what I think is interesting too is, you know, we always talk about like hunting for things in your environment, but there's a lot of things you can do even with like actions and activity with developing your threat intel or looking for potentially new threats. And you know, we've talked about it before, like DNS Twister, right? You know, if we're seeing a lot of attacks where people are trying to spoof or make potential domains that are similar to, and like, you know, in this case, they did list off, like if you're looking for domains, that's the one thing I like about this article is the end. They kind of give you like, what should you do lists, which I thought was cool. So they give you like, you know, look for keywords like tickets or ticket portals or Okta or SSO being attached to different domains to help, which what they were doing to try to spoof certain things. and especially anything involving your company or company name. Because if you can find registered domains out there, one, you can already determine if they're legitimate or not. And you can put in preemptive just blocks outright. So you can kind of have some defense that way, but you also kind of in the know, right, of things that potentially can be leveraged against you. And then you can uncover patterns. And I think this is a great work for like threat intel folks to, understand, how people are positioning potentially, and you can kind of get ahead of some of those things. So that part's kind of cool, from a proactive, way to do kind of threat intel and defense, versus trying to react to some of these, kind of campaigns that you could get hit with. So that was kind of my biggest take looking at some of these things is like, what would you do, for these types of attacks? And it's just, you know, thinking through the problem and, you know, finding the different data sources that may be relevant to looking through the data and, discovering the things that you can walk away with actions versus just kind of being in the know, like these things are happening. So yeah, it's kind of my big takeaway that I liked about this, and they gave pretty good suggestions at the bottom as far as like how to potentially look for domains associated with this specifically. But then, you know, people are hit some actions you should take as far as, you know, terminating sessions, initiating scans on your host if you can, to see if there's anything else to look for, disabling users, potentially try to follow up with if you have any MFA on things, potentially rolling things there or trying to see the use of those things. So, but yeah.
Yeah, for sure. All right, Scott, what's last this week?
All right. So this last one I thought was really interesting. And it's from We Live Security article, and it's called, and it came from ESET Research, but it's Update WinRAR Tools Now, ROMCOM and Others Exploiting Zero-Day Vulnerability. And basically, it's an interesting vulnerability because you can apparently do alternate data streams. We've talked about alternate data streams, I think, before, where in NTFS, the file system that Windows primarily uses, you can have a file and you can actually create an alternate data stream and have basically a file attached to a file, or like, you know, kind of hide things that way, right? So it's kind of something as this. I didn't know there are alternate data streams for RAR archives as well. So what this essentially did was you'd have this RAR archive that would be sent to you. And if you opened up the archive with WinRAR, you would only see, you know, the one file in there that is, I think, benign. And you wouldn't see anything else attached because there'd be alternate data streams. But when you go to open anything, it will basically take the files in the alternate data streams and it will deploy those files as well. And so in multiple iterations, it's usually an LNK file, so a shortcut file. And then in the first example, I think other ones as well, but they deploy a DLL as well. And so what's fascinating is, okay, so you're like, you unzip or unrar something, you get a bunch of errors because it does, when it does move the files over to those locations, so the shortcut is puts in the startup folder, so that when your computer then starts, it will run what's there, which that shortcut will then launch whatever the malicious payload, which in this case was the DLL, through Edge. That's how they get their persistence and that's how they get their execution done. But they have a bunch of errors of where they're trying to basically do this path traversal to drop these files on a location to kind of muddy the prompt that shows up as an error of all these things that are, it just junk data. And you're like, okay, you're still able to get to what you wanted to. You don't think anything with errors, but it buries their actual actions in the error log. So it's kind of their attack. And they've done a few different attack chains similar to this, right? Where they had another one. So they did the MS Edge DLL, right? With the updater LNK in the startup that would, when Edge launches, it would pull in the DLL. Then they had one where they, what was the malware that was? Snipbot. So they were able to kind of deploy Snipbot. Similar thing. Basically, they had the EXE drop, but they still used the LNK from the startup folder to launch it. And same thing with Melting Claw. Melting Claw was another malware that they were using. And same idea. You have they have a LNK, a shortcut link called set it folder, and it launches another executable that it drops as part of that persistence. So, you know, what's fascinating to me is, you know, it's kind of cool to see over time how this is being leveraged, but every single time their whole method of execution and persistence is dropping something in the startup folder, which people should already be kind of looking for writes to the startup folder in general. And LNK files are used more and more, the shortcut files in attacks. So seeing them created in weird location is also worth noting. And so if you have ways to you just know what LNK files are created or edited, it's good to pay attention to. But yeah, so if you know, it's an interesting exploit. I learned, you know, a little bit about how RARs and alternate data streams, which did not know, but knowing that I should be paying attention to anything going in a startup folder, is paying attention to shortcuts, and not knowing about any of these types of attacks or the 0 days, like, you still can be positioned right to defend against something like this, just doing the right things. And it's kind of the simple thing. So like, the attack's pretty cool and it's clever, right? But you definitely could have come across this without even knowing this attack existed. So those are the key things that stood out to me that I thought were pretty cool. And apparently it's, you know, pretty big. They have a big push to get this patch out there. So the CVE, if anyone's curious, it's the CVE 2025-8088. It's the one that directly ties to this. So what were your thoughts when you saw all this?
Pretty similar to what you were talking about. But there was a couple, I mean, there was one, I don't think you necessarily pointed this out, I thought it was cool just to kind of touch on. So they talk about the Snipbot variant execution chain in here. So the Snipbot piece, you know, it's a malicious link that's dropped via the same methodology, but the malicious link that's displayed, and it's basically a modified version of PuTTY, with additional code, and that additional code is leveraged to decrypt strings for the next stage, which is the shellcode. But it does talk about the execution of that shellcode only proceeds if it's a specific registry value. For this example that they give, it's 68. If that value is present in the registry key for software, Microsoft Windows Current Version Explorer Recent Docs. So in other words, if at least 69 documents were recently opened, basically using it as an anti-aliasing technique to prevent execution in like virtual machines and sandboxes. That was kind of interesting. It was a small little side point that I caught in the article when I read it that I wanted to note if you didn't touch on it, but it was pretty cool. The aliasing, anti-aliasing technique that was leveraged there, but yeah.
Yeah. The one thing I didn't mention that I wanted to as well is we've talked a little bit in the past about this, but they did also use COM hijacking and so to kind of, I guess, easily explain COM hijacking, there are configurations, there's CLSIBs in the classes in the registry for the software, and it basically, those CLSIBs can be leveraged. If you have an executable that needs the loaded DLL or needs to have access to some other process, so the inner process can kind of communication and capabilities, so you don't have, you know, that's how processes can kind of leverage each other. There's things that get stored there that tell that process kind of where to go to get access to those extra DLLs or processes. And the registry key typically for those are buried in the classes, CLSIDs, you know, some sort of GUID number, and then there's a registry key that's usually in proc server 32. And if you set that or edit that, then that will basically tell when you launch a certain process to then pull that DLL into memory or load it or do whatever it needs to do. And that's what they did for the MS Edge DLL. They did some comm hijacking there. So they point, when they drop that malicious DLL, in the updater LNK shortcut, it would basically change that registry value as part of its execution to change that registry to make Edge actually pull in that DLL and load it. So that's a kind of a savvy way to take advantage of certain things, especially if you can get, if you know what DLLs and things are supposed to load or will be loaded. But it's easy to also look for too, because Improc Server 32 stuff usually doesn't change or get edited, like those registry values don't, unless there's like updates and stuff that can happen there. So you shouldn't see a lot of those essentially. And they're worth monitoring that specific key. But yeah, so kind of a cool, like I said, a cool little thing to see. I would say more of a novel way to attack that was going under the radar for some time. But our standard way we look at the problems and hunt for behaviors, we would have caught it as well. So
behaviors.
I know. Just trying to keep it simple. So yeah, I think that concludes kind of some of the things we're going to touch on this week. So I really want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And with that, that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of August 11th, 2025. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.